Welcome to the History Sibyl, and today is August 24th. I'm going to be sharing with you Crusades Against the Pagans, and this is a chapter from Volume 9 of The Secret History of the Witches, my series on what happened in Europe. And this is an important subject that most people don't know anything about. It's very well known. The numbered crusades, the ones we read about, everyone gets taught, were European invasions of Palestine, Syria, North Africa, under the pretext of holy war against Islam, against Muslims. And also in the Spanish Reconquista, also you have the Visigoths, or the ruling class, at least, of Germanic rulers over Spain, fighting a centuries-long crusade against the Muslims. But other crusades were fought against pagan Europeans. And these crusades do not appear in the textbooks that we all were given, not even in colleges. And educational system refuses to acknowledge, really, the existence of pagan Europeans during the Middle Ages. You know, the narrative says, well, they all converted, you know, King so-and-so converted and he baptized everybody. And now the whole country is Christian. Magic wand was waved. But the medieval church did a lot more than recognize their presence. From the 10th to the 14th centuries, popes and bishops repeatedly called the Knights of Christendom to attack pagan European countries, pagan peoples. And they promised blessings to those who conquered the heathen. More importantly, they threw the power of the church behind the conquerors, and this provided material wealth to those who came in as the invaders, as dominators. The background, and we look at the literature, war against pagans and Muslims was the main subject of the classic epics of this era. Around the year 1000, the Chanson de Roland praises Charlemagne for invading pagan Vasconia, Basque country, there between Spain and France. And Spain, that was then ruled predominantly by the Muslims. The epic El Cid deals also with the Spanish wars on the Moors, part of that reconquest by the Christian lords of northern Spain. In Russia, the Lay of Igor is about a Kievan war on the pagan Polyanitsy, the tribes of the fields in Ukraine. And other lesser works, lesser known works, take this theme up as well. So in the French epic Pelvaux le Gallois, non-Christians are slain without mercy. And a knight remarks, after having slaughtered many people, "They that are unwilling to believe in God shall die like mad folk and devils." And so he straightway slew all the others, for that they were not minded to believe. So conversion here is a justification for conquest. And this political paradigm of the early centuries of Christianization in Europe at the end of the Roman Empire still held. Popes bestowed rulership and lands on Christians who conquered non-Christian lands. And the church hierarchy threw Muslim and pagan lands to whoever could conquer them, as long as these new lords professed Catholicism. So they recruited German knights to crusade against the pagan Wends of Sclavonia. This means the country of the Slavs. This is the westernmost Slavs in Europe, in what is now predominantly more in Germany, some of Poland as well, Pomerania. And the crusaders were given lordship over the tribes they were able to bring under military domination. The popes granted rulership over vast reaches of the Baltic countries to the Teutonic Knights in return for forcibly Christianizing the people there. And this pattern of conquer the heathen cast a very long historical shadow. Later on, in the colonizing of the Americas, papal decrees divided vast unconquered native countries between Spain and Portugal. And sometimes you will see Christian countries being victimized in similar ways. For example, in 1155, an English pope bestowed lordship over most of northern and central Ireland on the King of England. But the first crusade to be preached against Europeans was the invasion of pagan Sclavonia. So this is like Central Europe, going a little bit into Eastern Europe. And we do have earlier wars against the Wends on the record that had been fought since the 900s, but these were not given the title of crusades at that point. You know, this is all before the actual first famous crusades are launched against Palestine. So in the early 1100s, Bishop Otto of Bamberg instigated violent missionizing attacks against the Eastern Wends. And so Bamberg at that time, along with Magdeburg, were the far eastern frontier outposts of German Christianity, and after that, it's Slavs and pagans. So in 1147, you find monks preaching an official crusade against the Wends and Sorbs. And within 50 years, the Germans and Poles had divided up rulership of what is now East Germany. And they got, in for their pains, a papal decree approving their seizure. And so, having plunged through the Wendish country, through Sklavonia, the German Drang nach Osten, the drive to the east, now set its sights on Latvia, Estonia, and Prussia. So these are all the Baltic countries. So let's turn to the Baltic pagans. We know that during the 1200s, these countries along the Baltic Sea were staunchly pagan. People speaking Latvian and Finnic languages, such as the Estonians, maintained their tribal communities in a land of forests, meadows, and marshes. And these Baltic societies, I won't say they weren't male-dominated, but they were perhaps less so. They were certainly not as class-ranked as those of their conquerors. And early Christian missionaries were expressing their amazement at the non-feudal culture of the old Prussians, not to be confused with the Prussians, the German Prussian state of the 19th century that became such a famous militaristic society. These are the original inhabitants of what is called Prussia. So we see in 1075, Archbishop Adam of Bremen, so this is from a guy from northwestern Germany, writing about them. They go out to help those who are in peril at sea, who are attacked by pirates. Gold and silver they hold in very slight esteem. Living, moreover, in inaccessible swamps, they will not endure a master among them. So this is kind of a communalistic and really egalitarian culture from the early descriptions we have of the old Prussians. And missionaries had very little success among these people, who called evangelizing monks the ignorant ones and refused to let them enter their own sacred places because the monks could be counted upon to behave badly by attacking sacred images and profaning the sanctuaries. And people knew from experience that the monks would try to desecrate or even destroy these holy places. Here's another quote from a German Christian source. Many praiseworthy things could be said about these people with respect to their morals. If only they had the faith of Christ, whose missionaries they cruelly persecute. Although they share everything else with our people, they prohibit only, to this very day indeed, access to their groves and springs, which they aver are polluted by the entry of Christians. And, you know, this is not, I would not take this as a form of social prejudice against Christians, but rather a self-protective measure undertaken after seeing the bad behavior of these same missionaries. And so, like other pagans in Europe, the Baltic peoples held animus traditions of sacred groves that were inhabited by forest maidens. And they were guardian spirits who protected animals and birds, who punished wasteful hunters, disrespectful hunters, who they would take the game away if they did not behave in a respectful manner to Earth and her children. In Estonia, they talked about the haljas, who often appeared to people as women who looked like a tree trunk from the back. And like the fairies in Western Europe, the haljas fed and healed creatures, animals that were wounded or sick. Latvian folk religion also abounds in immanent mothers of the natural world. And so they talk about the mātes, the mothers, and there's like 50 different titles that I was able to find of mātes, who were guardians of the forests, the seas, the rivers, the lakes, of fire, all kinds of features of the natural world. And this was a long-standing goddess culture. The primary framework is the mothers. And as far back as the year 98, we have the Roman writer Tacitus saying, the Baltic peoples worship the mother of the gods. This is from his work, Germania. In the year 1220, we have the Bishop of Paderborn, Oliver Scholasticus, describing the Baltic religions in this way. They honor forest nymphs, forest goddesses, mountain spirits, lowlands, waters, field spirits, and forest spirits. They expected divine assistance from virgin forests, wherein they worshipped stones and trees, mounds and hills, steep stones and mountain slopes, all of which presumably endowed mankind, just put a little sick in there, with strength and power. So humanity, we'll substitute humanity for mankind. Female deities loom large in these Baltic folk traditions. And all of the societies, and these are speaking different languages, Estonian is Finnic, Lithuanian and Latvian are Indo-European. All these peoples revered Earth as mother. They honored her at plowing and planting, at the hearth, and at gravesites. And people made offerings to her on all the important occasions of life. They would ritually kiss her at sunrise and sunset. A lot of this information here is from Maria Gimbutas' book on the Balts that was published in the mid-60s. And the great goddess of Estonia was Maa-Eema, Mother Earth. The Latvians described Zemis Mate, Earth Mother, as the life giver brimming with vital power. And she causes Siela, life force, to pass into new forms. Whenever a living being dies, their Siela returns to Zemis Mate and circles back into new life. So that's a glimpse of these cultures. There's a lot more documentation, because these cultures resisted very strongly the forcible Christianization I'm about to describe to you. Embroidery, carving, the bathhouses, which were places of ceremony and healing, also places where births were carried out. There's a lot of material culture that carried forward right to the 20th century. Festival celebrations that are really structured around honoring the life principle and the cycles of life and death. But what I want to turn to now is this process of these invasions. And I'm going to talk about the Brotherhoods of the Sword. So the German crusaders succeeded in conquering the lands of the Vagrian Wends, east of the Elbe River. And then they launched a series of colonial cities along the Baltic coast, coming out of the port city of Lübeck, so out of northern Germany, and then going along that northern coast there. And by the year of 1187, you see German military expeditions starting to invade the Baltic countries from those outposts that they had founded along the coast. And here's one source. I think this is La Tourette, his history of heathen Europe. German adventurers, often in the guise of crusaders, subjugated the non-German peoples and hewed out estates for themselves. Christian missionaries sometimes constituted the outposts of German power. And he does a lot of documentation showing that linkage between conquest and domination with this project of Christianization. That's how it played out. So we have our first Baltic crusade marching against Livonia in 1198. When the Livs asked the invaders why their country was being attacked, the newly appointed bishop told them it was because the Livs had repeatedly turned away from the faith to paganism, like dogs to the vomit. This is an interesting phrase that we see starting to be used by the clergy somewhat before this time. You see it used a lot around heretics or Jews who were converted and then said, I don't like this, I'm going back, like dogs to the vomit. So there's this very, very profound disrespect to other people's cultures and spiritual values. So the Livs were, of course, offended, but they gave him the lesson to this, the bishop in religious principles of toleration. We refuse to accept this reproach. After thou hast sent back the army, thou mayest return with thy men in peace to thy bishopric. Thou mayest compel those who accept the faith to keep it. Thou mayest induce others to accept it by words, but not by rods. So there's a really strong contrast here, the military mode of conversion and then their values in Livonia to say, well, you know, individual people can believe as they want, and we accept that, but you cannot use force, and you cannot, you must respect others. So the response of the crusaders was to devastate the countryside, quote, by fire and by sword. And Bishop Berthold performed thousands of forced baptisms. But when these great armies finally were departed back to Germany, the Livs plunged into the waters of the Daugava River, saying, we now remove the baptismal water and Christianity itself. And casting off the imposed faith, we send it after the withdrawing Saxons. This is a quote from a medieval source that's called Scriptores Rerum Livonicare, Livonicarum, the writings of Livonian things. So the response of Pope Innocent III, not a really great name for this man who was a real heavy-duty witch hunter also, he responds by sending another crusader host against Livonia. And so this time they reach as far as Lithuania, establish a beachhead fortress at Riga in the year 1201. And then you have the first bishop of Livonia, Albert, founding a military monastic order called Fratres Militae Christi, or Brothers of the Sword. So they adopt the monastic rule of the Templars, who started out in the Crusades against Palestine. And they took vows to conquer and convert the Baltic people. By 1210, the Brothers of the Sword had conquered most of Livonia. So that would be mostly Latvia, probably. By 1217, they ruled southern and western Estonia. And in 1225, conquered Courland and Zemgal. So as these invasions were going on, you have certain princes of the Zemgalian people converting and allying themselves with the Christian monks. There was power to be had in allying with the invader. And this is a pattern you see a lot in history with empire. But the Zimgallians and the Letts, the Livonians, were so enraged at collaboration of this kind that the Germans had to provide these men with armed protection. And their own account of one of their raids on Lithuania in the year 1215 explains why people hated anyone who aided the Brothers of the Sword. When we arrived there, we spread troops all over roads, villages, and districts of the country. We set on fire and destroyed everything. We killed all of what was of masculine sex, captured women and children, and took away much cattle and horses, and returned to Livonia with much rejoicing. This is again from Scriptores Rerum Livonicarum. A century earlier, the popes had sent roving missionaries to pagan Estonia, but they made no progress in persuading the Eesti to convert. So by the mid-1100s, once again, the archbishops resorted to force, and they were backed this time by Danish warlords, Valdemar I and the warrior archbishop Absalon, led these invasions. And Valdemar II conquered more Estonian territory by 1202. The Pope obligingly granted him title over the entire country of Estonia and any other pagan lands he was able to conquer. And so the Estonians were subjugated by an all-out war, and the people were slaughtered in their homes, villages, and fields. And here again from the Scriptores, and all the roads and places were colored by the blood of the pagans, and they were persecuted in all the districts. And at last, on the fourth day, they took with them women, children, and maidens, and carrying away much booty, they returned with great rejoicing to Livonia and praised the Lord for the revenge taken on the heathens. And the pagans were perplexed and made great weeping and sorrowing, and mostly on the count of the multitude of the slain, of whom there were uncounted numbers. You can't help but be struck by the similarity of this account to some of the early invasions of North America, or other, all the entire European invasions in the Americas, in Africa, and in other places. You know, the absolute disregard for human life by men who claim to be followers of Yeshua of Nazareth. So in 1219, Valdemar II brings in a corps of bishops, and they begin forcibly baptizing the Eesti people, the Estonians. They rose up within a few years and overthrew the warlords from Denmark. And then Valdemar sold some of land that didn't really belong to him to the German Knights of the Sword. And so at this point, the Pope was forced to intervene in a squabble over which foreign army had the right to rule over the country. And he wound up returning 2/3 of Estonia to the overlordship of Valdemar. And so again, we've got reports of mass baptisms that are backed up by the occupying German armies. It wouldn't have been possible to carry out these conversions without the military force. And so we see German and Danish priests competing over conversion of the Eesti on the principle cuius baptisatio eius regio. He who baptizes, he shall have the rulership. And they were going so far actually as punishing those who had been baptized by the other party. So, you know, the Germans would say, well, you know, that was a Danish baptism. You have to let us do it. And this really puzzled the people. They're saying, well, we're baptized already. What more do you expect of us? People who performed pagan sacrifices were flogged at the church for 3 Sundays in a row, while people who attended pagan services were fined. So they would be forced to come up with money or possibly face confiscation of their lands. But the Estonian resistance continues. There was just numerous insurrections. We don't really have a count of that. But the Vatican was very quick to declare Estonia and Livonia converted. They sent out papal legates to plot out new dioceses, Roman imperial term, by the way, but adopted by the church. And they appointed entire hierarchies of priests to rule over these new conquered lands. Popes Innocent III and Honorius divided up Livonia, and they gave the bishops overlordship of two-thirds of those countries, and they left the rest to the ungentle rule of the Brotherhood of the Sword. These are huge swatches of territory. And so you see the German Emperor Frederick II claiming imperial overlordship over all these vast countries. The Livonians and Estonians were murdered and raped and driven into serfdom on their own plundered lands. So feudalism is now being brought to new countries in the name of the Lord, with oppression that was never known there before to that degree. And these conquerors swiftly instituted witch hunting laws. So the Livonian peasant law, copied from German town laws of the 1300s, ordered that, quote, heretics and sorcerers shall be burned. There was a law code called the Livonian Mirror, which was modeled on the German Sachsenspiegel, which took up its call for burning witches. So this is very, very difficult to document. I mean, we do have these written references, but they're very hard to track down. But we're seeing, again, this importation of witch persecutions under these new Christian regimes, these new feudal Christian lordships. So the next target was Old Prussia. And clerics referred to these people as stubborn pagans. There were very few converts to Christianity. And in fact, there were so few of them that Pope Innocent III ordered them to all be brought together into a strategic hamlet. That's a term I'm borrowing from the U.S. Vietnam War. The lords of Poland were pushing back the Prussian frontier on their side. But the influence of pagan priestesses was still powerful enough to be a factor in the invasion. So in 1209, we have a report from the Chronicon Monti Sereni that Duke Conrad ordered a Pythonissa to perform a divination on the outcome of his next battle. So Pythonissa is a Latin term borrowed from Greek that refers to a prophetess who is usually a trance priestess. There's a shamanic dimension to this. The name itself means a python woman. And the Duke demands a prediction of victory, threatening to kill the priestess if she failed to produce this outcome. So basically, he's trying to get people to believe, you know, our military undertaking is going to be a success because that will help make it a success. And the divination involved a ritual in which the priestess carried water in a sieve. If water flowed through, it was taken as an omen of defeat. And so we don't have any name for this priestess who fell hostage to the feudal conquest of her people. But others of her kind would have retreated into the forests and been part of the resistance. In 1217, Pope Honorius preached a crusade against Prussia, and that was launched out of Poland. He called for a baptism of all the captives taken. And also, he asked Christians to donate money to the church so that native boys could be trained up as missionaries and to purchase girls to be raised as Christians. So they were going to enslave the girls, the Prussian girls. And apparently, Prussian women could be converted no other way. They were so desperate to bring them up from early childhood so they could condition them. This crusade failed, however. And meanwhile, we have German abbots preaching that rich and poor should go to colonize Prussia. And so we've got an advance wedge of Cistercian missionaries streaming into Prussia and then bringing in their wake an influx of German settlers. But these colonies really owed their success ultimately to the Teutonic Order of Hospitallers. Like the Templars, this was a group that had come into being, aristocratic military monastic group during the Crusades against Asia. And they had gotten rich on Palestinian loot. So these elite crusader fraternities did not allow any religious considerations to interfere with their main activity, which was waging wars of conquest. In 1211, the King of Hungary invited, fairly recently converted himself, invited the Teutonic Knights to come to Transylvania to fight the pagan Cumans. And this was a Turkic people who had settled in southeastern Europe. They had come across through the Ukraine. The Teutonic Knights soon quarreled with the king, and he kicked them out of Hungary. And he was not the only Christian European ruler in Eastern Europe to seek the help of crusaders in this war against pagan tribes. We can see the Polish Duke of Mazovia and Kujawia warring on the old Prussians to his east. And you have Duke Conrad inviting the Teutonic Knights to help themselves to those lands. And he's backed up by the Bishop of Kulm. So the Teutonic Order quickly seizes control of the territories that had been offered to them in a ruthless invasion. This was in 1228. And a couple years later, the Pope authorized them to crusade against Prussia and sent in Dominican monks across Central Europe to recruit reinforcements for these invasions. And so the Pope is calling for a new crusade against pagan Europe. This is Gregory the Ninth. And he urged the Teutonic Knights to revenge the injuries caused to the Savior by the heathens. They gladly obliged, devastating the country, committing atrocities such as disemboweling Prussians who resisted. And so this process continues. More German knights come out from bases in Germany and Czechoslovakia to establish fortresses in Prussia and on the Lithuanian frontier. And the Pope offered to pardon freed criminals if they would join the crusade. So they were really desperate to get boots on the ground in there because the resistance was effective. And in fact, Lithuania becomes the center of pagan resistance to the German invasion of Baltic countries. In 1235, the Livonian Brotherhood of the Sword launched a crusade against Lithuania, and the people there wiped out its high command and most of its army. And this great pagan victory, quote, ignited violent insurrections in Prussia and Livonia. So people took heart because they said, look, the Lithuanians did this and we can do it too. And so they rose up against their overlords. This first Prussian insurrection, as it was called, was put down by the knights with mass killings and village burnings. And many of the Prussian survivors fled eastward into Lithuania, where it was safe. They spoke related languages. So the crusaders are going around founding cities, Königsberg and other fortified German cities, and importing peasants from Germany to settle Prussian land. So this is how, you know, this is the roots of the Prussian militarism that I was referring to earlier in under the Kaisers. These really brutal invasions. And so in 1237, the Teutonic Order absorbed the remnants of the Livonian Brothers of the Sword and now had taken over rulership of most of the Eastern Baltic. The German Emperor Frederick II gave the rank of Imperial Prince to the Grand Masters of the Teutonic Order. And so they made a treaty in 1249, known as the Treaty of Christburg, and the old Prussian deities and spiritual leaders were abolished. The Vatican approved this treaty, which also decreed a loss of freedom for any Prussians who refused to convert to Christianity. And it taxed people to build churches and to pay for support of the German priesthood. So pagan animism is forced underground. And the order came after them and was really looking to identify the elements of their belief in order to more effectively stamp it out. So the 1249 treaty, for example, refers to the idolo of Kirche, which the Prussians made after the harvest. So an idol, right, in a particular place. And this Kirche survived in farm culture. It was invoked to keep insects off the crops. So this is part of, you know, it's really integrated into the agricultural life of the people. It may have been like a corn dolly, as the English call it, a effigy made out of wrapped or bound or knotted straw from the harvest itself. There are a lot of examples of that around Europe. Those who invoked the old divinities were likely to be accused of sorcery, according to the pattern in the other forcibly converted countries of Europe. And we see from papal correspondence that the Teutonic Order used trials by ordeal, by fire or boiling or icy water. And the Prussian villagers under this new order were legally, socially, and economically disadvantaged, which is to say they were oppressed. The elders that headed their communes had to report to the Teutonic Order, and it claimed judicial rights over all Prussians. This is a pattern in the European warlord system more generally in feudal Christian states. And the knights did the same as they did in France and England and other places, conscripted people into heavy labor. So they were forced to build fortifications for the order's attacks on the Eastern Front. And, you know, they were, in order to do this work, they were marched away from their fields. It interrupted their harvest. Their own survival was actually interfered with by being forced to do this corvée labor. And they were taxed mercilessly. We see in 1260 the old Prussian elders appealing and pleading with the order to lessen their taxes being paid in grain, because people spent many days working on the estates of the monasteries while their own fields went untended. They say, "The children are suffering from hunger, and now you want to take the last piece of bread from their mouths." In response, and this tracks a little bit with some legendary accounts, but this is what the chronicles say. The order invites 50 elders to a feast, locks them in a building, and burns them alive. We see the same story being told about Princess Olga versus the Drevlanie, the people of the forest, in the conversion of the Ukraine, maybe 200 years before. So this atrocity provokes the second Prussian insurrection, and that went on for 14 years. And again, papal bulls are calling in masses of crusaders to help put down this insurrection. But even then, the old Prussians are continuing really heroically to resist the Teutonic Order. They endured long sieges in their walled cities, but most of the country was subjugated by 1283. And when their last strongholds were finally ground down to defeat after 5 long years of war, the knights forcibly baptized the survivors. So there's no choice involved here. You know, you're going to be Christian, like it or not. And the treaties, which were, of course, dictated by the conquerors, demanded that all Prussians be baptized, that those who refused must be shunned, that any baptized person who practiced pagan religion would be reduced to slavery. This is a pattern that we saw also in Western Europe that was done to the Saxons and the Wends, for example. And pagan worship was banned. The conquered must build churches, attend them on Sundays and feast days, must pay support to the clergy, and submit to its regulation. all male priesthood, of course. And these are peoples that did have priestesses. The colonial statutes required landlords and employers to monitor the religious practices of their serfs, checking, for example, to see if they were able to say the Lord's Prayer. Very devout. And they subjected the Prussians, as we were talking about a minute ago, to witchcraft laws. This was something new to them, as far as we know. And the penalties were harsh, including physical mutilation. The order repeatedly made laws penalizing witches, called Zauberer or Zauberinne. These are words for sorcerer and sorceress in German. And this is, again, looking at the Scriptorum Rerum Prosicarum. One of the sources I draw on deems these witches, quote, the pathetic remains of a once proud pagan priesthood, rather than common or garden variety charlatans. Well, that's nice of him to recognize that, I guess. But there was no paper trail left of these methods of enforcement. The same source, Burleigh, says the records of the order's judicial activities are, quote, sparse, limited to some wax tablets from the commandery of Danzig in the early 1400s. And so by 1310, we are still seeing, however, laws along the borders of Prussia showing that sorcerers, put that in quotes, were branded on the cheek, had an ear chopped off, were exiled, or had to pay large fines to their rulers. The Edict of 1310 was read out three times every year following that, banned the native language, which was related to Lithuanian. It barred the old Prussians from trading, holding office, or living in the new German cities. So there's a kind of apartheid being enforced. They actually forbade intermarriage. When the colonists recaptured people who escaped from this serfdom, they dragged them back to the manor on a leash tied to iron rings thrust through their ears. Maybe even, you know, dragging them, physically dragging them behind the horses. So these are all atrocities meant to intimidate the entire population. And when a Prussian man died, the German lord seized the family's land and half its livestock. So there are these death taxes that you see also being imposed in Western European feudalism. They were continuing to draft the old Prussians into heavy labor, building fortifications and so forth. What's amazing is that in spite of the risks, the old Prussians remained loyal to their spiritual traditions. They paid the feudal tribute because they had to, but they celebrated their rites and visited their forest sanctuaries in secret. After 200 years of repression from the Teutonic Order, it had barely made a dent in the pagan loyalties of the old Prussians. We see in 1427 a Carthusian monk writing that paganism was still prevalent and that people ignored the Christian feasts. So this is a really deep-seated popular resistance. One historian remarked that the ecclesiastical authorities in East Prussia had their hands full stamping out heathen practices in the full 16th century. By the 1600s, the last survivors of old Prussia were culturally and ethnically submerged in the tide of settlers. The new German Prussians inherited the militarism of the Teutonic Knights, whose legacy was the warlike reputation of modern Prussia. So I'm going to stop there. There's another episode, and I'm going to talk more about Lithuania, because so far we've only seen the conquest of Latvia, Estonia, and Old Prussia, which is, you know, later became part of Eastern Germany, but was originally not ethnically German. We're going to look more at length at the long struggle to conquer Lithuania, who were not converted to Christianity until the end of the 1300s. And so there's more combat that went on there. And we're going to look a little bit at some of the spiritual beliefs in that Lithuanian culture. But that's a good enough chunk right there for now. Hope that you will visit my Patreon, patreon.com/MaxDashu. And if you like being able to know about this hidden information, consider sponsoring. You can also visit the Suppressed Histories Archives on Facebook, which has posts pretty much every day on more global topics than what I'm covering right now in this series on the pagan crusades. But it certainly relates to what happened globally in the conquest of the rest of the world by European powers. And the Suppressed Histories website is another place you can visit some of the publications, including my book, Secret History of the Witches. The volume 7 is titled Witches and Pagans, Women in European Folk Religion, 700 to 1100. And so there's a lot of resources on those sites that you can look up as well. But thank you for listening. See you next time.